Session number 27075, reel 29.
Squadron Leader Leggett, reel 29.
So, the orders kind of came through to fold up Ratmalere and make it, get it all teed up for return to civil aviation, which no doubt would be coming along before long. As for myself, my orders were quite simple, to dispose of all buildings that were no longer required, and for all the service supply and material to be accounted for and made ready for removal.
At this point, would you have had a demobilisation number coming through?
Yes, I would have done. I have no idea what it was, but certainly I had a number. But what I had to do was hand over control of Ratmalere to the only remaining unit, which is an MTLRU, Motor Transport Light Repair Unit. And that was to remain to maintain all the transportation in that part of Ceylon, because obviously a lot of transport was going to be required. So I literally sat down and wrote out the admin order, in which I simply transferred everything, all the, first of all the monies, this is to say public, non-public funds, like the officers' mess funds, sergeants' mess funds, any monies at all had to be accounted for and handed over to the accountant officer of the MTLRU, who are going to take over control of the unit, of the station. The equipment officer's job was to pack up all his stuff, clothing in particular. And again, this was all handed over, lock, stock and barrel, to this remaining unit. By now, of course, there were no flying operations of any sort, apart from the odd communication aircraft coming and going. But we were closing down all facilities. And lo and behold, the orderly room flight sergeant came down one morning and said, this might interest you, sir. Gave me a slip of paper. Acting Squadron Leader Leggett to report to RAF Station Nagumbo for transportation to UK on demobilisation. Just like that. So, I packed my bags and said my goodbyes, climbed in a truck, set off from Ratmalere, went through Colombo, came out on the other side, drove up the road towards Nagumbo, which we reached, and this is a brand new station that was still under construction, and indeed is still there to this very day. It is now, in fact, the International Airport for Ceylon, or Sri Lanka as it's now called. And so that we found the entrance to this station, the camp, could see some aeroplanes, and we were driving up a track which was up on a raised embankment, and only half of it was usable. And they'd put logs, whole palm tree trunks, down the middle of this track, and the idea was that you kept to the one side of the track, of the logs. We were beetling along here, and he was going a little bit fast. A 1,500 weight truck, my kit in the back. And all of a sudden, there was one of these logs had slewed a bit, so at the end was protruding into our path. Well, he slammed on his brakes, but wasn't quick enough. And the front wheel struck this log hard, The whole vehicle leapt in the air, jumped over the rest of the logs, and proceeded off down the embankment at a high rate of knots. And at the bottom of the bank was a whole row of palm trees. And we were going to plunge ourselves in the middle of these trees in no time at all. So I got my feet up. I shouted, "Get your feet up!" We put our feet up on the dashboard. People didn't have straps in those days. Got our feet up on the straps board and hit a tree fair and square. And the tree came between him and me. And we were both pretty shaken, but got away with it somehow. How we didn't go through the windscreen, I don't know. Anyway, we got ourselves together, and somebody had seen what had happened, and people came. And we just got our kit taken up to the headquarters building, which wasn't far away. And I wrote out a statement for the driver and said it was entirely due to the unserviceable nature of the track leading into the station that this accident had occurred, and LAC so-and-so is in no way responsible. Climbed aboard the aeroplane and set off for Lord knows where we are. I know we flew across the Nilgiri Hills, and that was an experience, looking down in this incredible jungle, real wild jungle, as far as I could see, Nilgiris. Landed at Cochin, and back to Worli Transit Camp. And I think I was only there for two or three days, and I was to board the City of Bombay. Yes, that's right, City of Bombay. Was it? Anyway, it was Union Castle, Cape Town car. That was it, the Cape Town Castle, Union Castle ship. And I was to be a ship's adjutant for the voyage home to UK. Well, being ship's adjutant was quite an advantage, because when I went aboard, I announced who I was and was taken to the next square where all the corridors led off, up top. And leading off this square was a cabin. And he opened the door into a little square receptacle. And to the left was a very nice bathroom. And another door led into a very nice, sizable cabin with a window, not a porthole, a window, and a proper bed. And under the window was a sofa, and lying on the sofa was a blonde. So I thought, well, now this really is service. Things aren't looking up. And she stirred as I came in. Oh, terribly sorry. I thought you were Dickie. No, I'm not Dickie. Who are you? Oh, well, I'm so-and-so, Lieutenant somebody. She was wearing a khaki uniform with pips on her shoulder. She said, oh, I'm a friend of somebody. She gave me a name. He is the ship's adjutant for the army, and he's sharing your cabin as ship's adjutant for the RAF. So I thought, it's fine. And are you coming with us? She said, unfortunately, no, she said. She said, I haven't got my posting home yet. However, we found that there were some refreshments to be had. Quite a nice bar. And that was a nice little send-off, I thought, from the subcontinent. And it was homeward bound, once more across the Indian Ocean, up the Red Sea again, whole length of the Mediterranean, and the Med was wild. It was absolutely atrocious. The clouds were right down, the waves were lashing, the wind was howling, it was belting with rain, it was awful. And I felt terribly sorry for there were a couple of chaps had married Indian ladies. Well, they're very high-class Indian ladies, these, because they wore a different gold-embroidered sari every night. And oh my goodness, they were so miserable. The moment we left Suez and headed out in the Mediterranean, this awful weather, and they turned from their rather lovely tan colour, they turned greys, and they looked dreadful, the poor souls. However, I dare say they survived. They probably went back to Indo-British.
Did you have many duties as ship's adjutant?
Not really, no, there wasn't very much to be done. We always had an orderly officer and an orderly sergeant, whose job it was to appear at all meals and inquire if there were any complaints. And my job, well, was to write out the roster for these duties, sort out any monetary problems they may have. One or two chaps wanted a loan, which I was able to extract out of the ship's purser, and that sort of thing. But most of the time, we used to watch the swingometer. In fact, the ship was rolling quite heavily coming across the Bay of Biscay. According to the captain, it was one of the wildest crossings he'd ever made in all his years at sea. And the ship really did roll quite heavily. And I suspended a pair of scissors on a cord, and then had a scale here, you see. And we'd have bets to see which end of the scale it was going to go to first. So that was all quite agreeable. And I got home. And within a few days, had a letter from the Air Ministry to inquire whether I'd be interested in taking an extended service commission. Well, I thought about this. The other prospect was to go back to Hawkers, where I'd been before the war. But that was going to be a bit of a plod, because there wasn't a great deal of enthusiasm for building military airplanes at that time. They were looking at other ideas, but none of it really appealed to me very much. And so I thought, okay, we talked to everyone. Well, we don't, it's a bit of an open-ended thing. I rang them up and said, what does extended mean? How extended, for how long? Well, unfortunately, we don't know. It all depends. It depends on what? Well, it depends on all sorts of things. We don't know. But I said, well, are we talking weeks, months, days, years? Oh, we're talking years. It'll be a few years, because there's a lot to be done to get the Air Force back onto a peacetime footing and so on. So I took the extended service commission.
What terms were they under, i.e. your pay and your rank? Did that change at all?
No. The acting stripe came off, of course. I was back to flight lieutenant. But otherwise, no, it was the same. And, of course, it moved very slowly. Every year, of course, you know, the defence budgets, defence estimates are issued, and this includes a section for pay for personnel of all ranks. It would move very slowly, but I'm not sure it moved during the war at all. It probably didn't. And that's possibly flying. Yes, well, what would happen, of course, you'd get flying pay. Or to qualify for flying pay, you had to do so many hours a year. This came along a little bit later. In the meantime, you were just getting flying pay. But a little bit later on, they said to qualify for flying pay, you must do so many hours. So that was fair enough. And so there I was, at home with my family, wondering what was going to happen next. And I was told to report to RF Uxbridge, which was the headquarters of number 11 Group Fighter Command. So I got to Uxbridge, into the SPO's office. He said, what do you want to do? Well, I'd heard there were such things as jet aeroplanes now. I hadn't seen any, but I'd heard they were about. So I said, well, I'm rather interested in these jets one hears about. Oh, I said, oh, well, yes, we can soon arrange that. He said, we've got X number of squadrons, I can't remember, probably 8, 10 maybe, in various parts of the country. Where would you like to go? So I said, well, an old friend of mine, a chap called Johnny Plagis, I hear he's operating one of these units. Oh, Johnny Plagis, yes, he said, well, he's up at Boxted. Oh, where's Boxted? Or at Colchester. So I thought, well, Colchester sounds all right. So I got there, and packed up the, by this time I got a little motor car. Had I? No, I hadn't got it then. When did I get that car? Yes, I had acquired a little motor car, so a little Morris 8, little rounded back Morris 8. And I could get myself and my wife and my son in his carry cot and all our luggage in this car, believe it or not. And Boxted was a wartime built station, and a few miles away was Horsham St. Faith. Horsham St. Faith, where there was a married quarter vacant. And that's where we were heading. And so I started in. There was this meteor squadron. And I think there were about 12 flight lieutenants. And a couple of warrant officers. And that's the way it was. Everybody had risen up to that level by then, you see.
Were you keen to get back to flying at that stage? Were you keen to get back to flying?
Oh, yes, that's what I wanted to do. And I wanted to get on these jet things. And, yes, they've got a squadron of jets, of Meteors, and an Oxford twin engine, the purpose of which was to educate people who'd not flown very much multi-engine into handling a twin-engined aircraft. So that was the job of the Oxford, which didn't resemble a Meteor very much. But I was given the pilot's notes for a Meteor, studied these for a few days, and then came the big day when I wandered out to the aircraft with Sammy Osborne, my flight commander. And he put me in the cockpit, and we went through the whole of the cockpit and all the instruments, went through all the various figures, particularly stalling speeds and landing speeds and so on. And he said, right, well, off you go. Don't bend it. So there I was in this amazing bit of machinery. It was a huge aeroplane compared to a Spit or a Hurricane. It was huge. Cockpit was quite comfortable. It wasn't particularly smart. There were bits and pieces hanging on here, there, and everywhere. But it fitted nicely. Everything was within easy reach and visible.
Can you give me an idea of the cockpit layout?
Yes, we had the essential blind flying panel with six instruments on it, which we'd been using right the way through ever since Advanced Flying Training School. That same instrument panel was still in use. Here we had a twin-engine aircraft, So we had two throttle levers in the usual place for, in the place where you normally find them in a single engine aircraft, where the left, for operation by the left hand, leaving the right hand free to handle the control column. So there'd be the throttle levers on the left, and below those, the lever. What was below that? No, I think it's just the throttle levers there. Then we had the undercarriage controls, which were down here. Flaps. And then ancillary bits and pieces. Oxygen. And of course there would be the engine instruments, rev counters, oil, jet pipe temperature, which was something new. It was something you had to watch very carefully when you were, particularly when you were starting up, not to overheat the jet pipe. They could melt if you overheated them. And then you had the reflector gun sight in front of you. And I think that's about it. It was a fair, comparatively simple cockpit, because jet engines are a fairly simple piece of equipment. There were the starting up procedure. Down beside the seat, there were two levers on either side. High pressure turbines and low pressure turbines. Pumps, rather. High pressure and low pressure pumps. And these fed fuel, obviously, from port side to the port engine, starboard to the starboard engine. And these pumps fed the fuel through. And there was a particular routine when you're starting up to adjust these pumps and the push buttons to start the thing rolling. But if you got the sequence right, the engine fired up quite easily. And there you are, engine's running, chocks away, taxi. And this is the first thing that struck me. What a nice machine it was to taxi. It had a very broad undercarriage. It felt very stable. You were sitting right up there on the nose, which was the great luxury after sitting behind engines all those years. Here you are sitting on the nose with a fantastic all-round vision. You could see 180 degrees pretty well. And it felt very, very comfortable. Got to the end of the runway. Got clearance takeoff. Turned into wind. And I realised they'd put me on the short runway. Instead of the 2,000-yard runway, they put me on the 1,800 one, or was it 1,600? Not sure. Anyway, it was the short one. However, I decided there was quite a strong wind blowing. I reckon it'd be all right. And so I got on the end of the runway and ran the engine up, let the brakes off, whoosh, and off we went, and got up quite nicely. And it was another world altogether. Rate of climb was extraordinary, passing up through the clouds in no time at all. Visibility on that day was very good, so I didn't have to worry too much about navigating. I could just pretty well fly around. I knew pretty well where the airfield was, and if I couldn't find that, there were at least another dozen airfields in sight, the whole of East Anglia covered in airfields, many of which would be perfectly suitable for a landing if necessary, although they were beginning to hand them back to farmers and had to be a little bit careful not to land on a farmer's collection of pigs or whatever. And so the next few weeks were spent learning to handle this machine, which was quite delightful. It handled well, a little bit heavy compared to the Spit and Hurricane, of course, much heavier, but not so heavy that you were wrestling the thing the whole time. It flew itself quite nicely. Landing was quite a an easy manoeuvre. Didn't it have any particular vices? You had to keep the speed right. The important thing with a jet coming into land is to remember that the engine, when you open up the throttle, the engine takes a little while to pick up compared to a piston engine where you get instant pick up when you open the throttle. If you're undershooting the airfield, push open the throttle to make sure you're going to get in with a jet aircraft, and this still applies to all jet aircraft today. You do have to open up that little bit earlier to allow the turbine to pick up its speed and give you that extra bit of thrust. So that was all very pleasant.
I believe the Meteor's got a tricycle undercarriage.
Yes, tricycle undercarriage. Oh yes, that was the first time I'd had that, of course. But the technique of landing was just the same. You'd come in on the correct approach to the landing place, and round out, level out in just the same way, and just put the aircraft down on the main wheels. It would run along a certain way. You could hold the nose up a little bit longer if you wanted to, by easing back on the stick. Just keep the nose up off the ground until it slowed down, and let the aircraft sink onto its nose wheel. It would just trundle along by itself quite happily. And then steering was very easy. This is that nice wide undercarriage. You could taxi without any danger of running into things that we always used to worry about.
What were the landing speeds like in comparison, say, with a piston engine aircraft?
Yeah, considerably higher. I must confess I can't recall exactly what the Meteor's landing speed was. I think it was around about 95. It might have been 105. I think it was 95. I think so. Nothing excessive there.
And obviously you were operating from a hard runway.
Yes.
Did the Meteor have potential to operate from grass strips at all, or would that have been too impossible?
On one occasion I did. It's a bit foolish, really, in retrospect. But one Wednesday afternoon, everybody had gone off to play golf or something or other. And I was hanging around. I'd got something on, I don't know what it was. And I was in the mess. The phone rang. One of the orderlies goes, I went on the phone. And there was a wing commander, somebody on the phone, to say, when are we going to get the Meteor? I said, what Meteor is that? Well, this is Marshall's Airfield, Cambridge, here. We've got an air display going on here. And we've been promised a Meteor. I said, oh, well, I know nothing about it, I'm afraid. The squadron commander and the flight commanders are off the station. I don't know anything about it. Oh, well, this is all very inconvenient. I was assured that we were going to have a Meteor on our display this afternoon. Hadn't you better do something about it? Hadn't you better... I said, well, I'm not sure I can. Well, he said, I'll accept responsibility, he said. I said, well, if that's the case, I'd better see what I can do. He said, yes, well, do hurry up. We've got the people, crowds of people here waiting to see you. And so, I got on the phone to the flight sergeant. And he said, well, we were just reeling the last one in. So he said, do you really want it to come out now? I said, well, I haven't got much choice, really. I'll be up there shortly. So I got into this Meteor and started up. And off I went to Marshall's at Cambridge. Well, what I didn't know is that it was a grass airfield. Anyway, I plunked it. It looked all right. And I plunked it down. It was a bit bumpy at the far end. But it was all right. I taxied in. And switched the thing off, and of course was swarmed around by crowds of people, and they all wanted to climb up and look in the cockpit and all. So it was all quite engaging, really. And